It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Some of you may not have heard that On Your Money will not be a regular hour-long segment as of the end of July. For those of you who are concerned that we are getting rid of Kevin McKinley, rest assured that is not the case. This is a very important topic, and Kevin is a much-beloved guest. This is a priority for WPR, and it's a priority for me. I like talking to Kevin, and I look forward to having more conversations. It just won't be weekly at this time. We want to have the flexibility to bring you the latest news and critical conversations, and we'd also like to have more financial discussions on our other Ideas Network shows, not just the Morning Show. So our plan is to have Kevin be a vital part of that, along with other financial experts. With that said, you are much adored by our listeners, Kevin, and I hear you have some greatest hits of the last 15 years.
Yes, thank you very much, Carrie, and I'm actually really excited about this because I have been told that I'm being taken to a big farm in the country with lots of room to run around with other financial planners. So I'm I'm very excited about
this. I'm not going to go into that metaphor anymore.
Yeah, we've been on since October of 2003. We have done over 600 shows, and at the end of the July will be our last Tuesday morning and Saturday rebroadcast shows. So over these next 3 weeks, I decided I wanted to cover a lot of the frequently asked questions, kind of our greatest hits, and kind of do it in an ages and stages manner so that we can have some things that people can take away from the On Your Money show and hopefully stick with them and help them going forward.
Okay. So what's the first thing we're talking about here?
We're going to talk about young adults today, and the subtopics are going to be student loans, what to do with them. We're going to talk about buying your first car and planning for children and buying a home. And I'm sure that even if you are not a young adult or if you're just young at heart, there still will be some information here that you can take away going forward as well.
I should note that Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. He's joining us from our studios in Eau Claire. And we are, as usual, taking your calls, 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Kevin, adulting, let's start with these terrible student loans.
It's a lot of money.
It is.
It's $1.4 trillion with a TR dollars in America.
Per person. No, sorry.
Per person. That's right. It's $1.4 trillion
per person. That's what it feels
person.
Like.
It does. And that's actually true, especially if you're a young adult and you're starting out and you've got this first paycheck, first big paycheck, and you're starting to wonder who FICA is and why that money is being deducted out of your hard-earned dollars. And then after everything's all paid for and you're expected to pay for your own groceries and everything, you still have this big student loan payment out. And for people who are curious about it, who aren't going through this, the median dollar amount out there for student loans on average for a new graduate of a four-year institution is about $30,000. And as we've talked about before, you can pay that off by making 1% of the original balance payment per month, and you can pay that off in 10 years. So if you have a $30,000 loan payment, it's $300 per month to pay it off in 10 years, usually. And hopefully that $3,600 per year in extra expense that you have is much more than offset by the extra earned income that a college degree can bring. And when you get it paid off in 10 years,
hopefully.
Let's say when you're, right. When you're 22 or 32 or 42, when the loans are all done and paid off, then the college degree sticks with you in the form of higher earnings power. But don't pay it down any faster than you have to. It has a very low interest rate. It doesn't have as big of an effect on your credit score as other types of debt do. And you may get a tax break on the interest that's charged. You should pay off credit card debt instead, especially if it's over 10% interest. And you should accumulate 3 months' worth of your typical living expenses in savings.
Mm.
And finally, save for retirement, at least $5,000 per person per year before you do anything in the way of paying the student loans off faster than you have to.
So for a lot of people starting out, that's a big ask.
Yeah, yeah, it is. It's
I mean,
a
if you're making $30,000 a year, then you can't really do that.
You can. It just involves a transition from college to adulthood, and doesn't work for every person, obviously. But one of the mistakes that we make or we're forced to make is when we move out of this really cruddy apartment or dorm room after we get our college degree, we move to a nicer area, we get a bigger apartment or a nicer apartment, we live by ourselves instead of living with six or seven other sweaty teenagers, and that starts to add up for it. So if people would really gradually move from the way their college lifestyle into their adulthood lifestyle, rather than saying, well, I was spending $30,000 a year in college. Now I'm making $30,000 per year. I should be able to afford these things. That's where people tend to get in trouble. And if they would try to live as cheaply as possible, a lot of people don't realize, Carrie, even for people who are relatively young, such as yourself, a lot of us got out of college.
You've met me, Kevin.
A lot of us got out of college and really lived a very monk-like existence while we were getting started. Just because we might have bigger houses and cars now and can afford to go out to eat a lot, we didn't have that when we were 22. And sometimes that's lost on young adults. They see their parents' lifestyle and they think, well, I'm an adult now like my parents. I should achieve that as well. And they don't realize that many of us shared apartments and drove really cruddy cars for a long time and scrimped by and ate mac and cheese, even though we were technically adults economically.
Right. So is there a time when people should pay down their student loans more quickly?
Yeah, if the interest rate is high, and by high, I mean generally over 7 or 8%, then the interest really can add up quickly, and so I'd like to see people pay it down more quickly then. But otherwise, if you're self-aware enough to say, hey, I've got $6,000 in my checking account right now, I know I'll blow through that if I don't apply it towards my student loans. And if you're that self-aware, congratulations. And then that's another time where you might want to slide it over to the debt rather than, you know, wherever else you're going to waste it.
And what about consolidating your student loans? Can we do that?
Yeah, when people graduate, they get a lot of pitches from these companies to say, hey, consolidate your loans. It'll make your payments easier. We've got a low introductory rate. And that can be a good idea if it lowers your payment. But a lot of times what happens is people consolidate loans they shouldn't. You should never consolidate federal student loans with private student loans, because federal student loans have a lot of advantages to making it easier to pay it off or temporary delay paying it off that private student loans do not. And once you consolidate the federal into the private, you can lose those advantages. So definitely keep them separate. Try to go out as long as you possibly can, but just watch the prepayment penalty. And even if there is a prepayment penalty, I would kick that proverbial can down the road so that you can get a lower payment now and afford other things and other necessities in life. Watch the fine print and just make sure that you know what you're signing on to before you get it. A lot of people, we get a lot of emails from people who say, I consolidated my student loans, and 2 years later, I'm in a deeper hole now than I was when I started. What happened? And usually what happens is they didn't pay attention to the terms and what could be affected if they only made the minimum payments or they agreed to a too high interest rate.
And a lot of people don't realize that some loans are federal loans and some loans are private loans.
In some cases, yeah, they can be private loans, and usually you have to go through the university financial aid office and fill out the FAFSA form, F-A-F-S-A, FAFSA form, right, to get any need-based financial aid anyway, any institutional aid, but then also to get those federal student loans.
We are talking to Kevin McKinley about adulting, about what you need to do to start out your financial life, and we're taking your calls, 800-642-1234. Kevin, okay, so somebody gets out of college, and they have this great degree, maybe even a master's degree, and they're trying to pay off their debt, and they can't find a job that pays them more than $30,000 to $35,000 a year, maybe even less than that. Maybe they're just working part time. What do they do if they can't afford their loan payments?
Well, when anyone runs into a financial problem, there are really only two answers to getting out of the hole, and that is to cut expenses and increase your income. That might mean moving home for a while. It might mean sharing an apartment or just living in a bedroom rather than having your own apartment. But it also might mean picking up, as you like to say, and I love this notion, a side hustle, a part-time job that can come up with even $200 or $300 a month. That's not a ton of time. If you're making $10 an hour at the side hustle, let's say, that's about 4 or 5 hours a week that you would have to do to make that $200 or $300 that would allow you then to make that payment. But don't miss the minimum payments. Move heaven and earth to try to make sure those minimum payments are already made, and definitely don't ignore the problem. If you find yourself short of cash when the student loan payment is due, contact the lender. You will not be the first person that day to call the lender and say, I can't make my payment.
That day.
And also, your situation is probably not nearly as bad as many of the ones that they've seen. So contact the lender and say, here's my situation. What are my options? And if it's federal loans, you may want to consider going to the website ibrinfo.org, ibrinfo.org, because as I mentioned, federal loans have a provision that allows you to slow down the amount of minimum payments and still stay current, and it's called income-based repayment, and you can go to ibrinfo.org, and we'll have a link to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And we are taking your calls and emails. We got Ken from Denmark, Wisconsin, not Denmark the country. He's wondering about the grandparent penalty of 549 college savings plans. They're 529 college savings plans. He says it can reduce financial aid awards by 50%, and he's wondering if there's a way to avoid that.
There can be, and it can be tricky. It shouldn't be something that precludes grandparents and other interested relatives from saving for saving for college expenses with a 529 plan. I'm a big fan of that if the grandparents can afford it, especially because a lot of times the grandparents are in a little better financial situation than the parents, and so they might have a little extra money to set aside. And 529 plans are a great way to do it because it allows the grandparents to maintain control of the money and get a tax break on not only the deposit, but also keep the earnings sheltered. And then when you pull the money out for qualified higher education expenses, it's tax-free. So it's a nice setup. But the problem is that if it's used incorrectly, it can hurt the need-based financial aid that schools might award. Now, a couple things about this. Most of the financial aid that is awarded is in the form of loans, not in the form of just free money laying around. There's lots of stories of kids go to a small liberal arts school and they get a big scholarship. But usually, those are for exceptional students and for smaller schools. If you're going to a state school, which most high school students do, especially in Wisconsin, there's not a lot of need-based aid there. So 529 plans held by a grandparent won't affect it. One way to get around the issue for it is to only start liquidating the 529 plan and use it for the last year or two of the kid's expenses. Have the kid borrow money in the federal loan program every single year, work, use some savings from the parents, etc. But then if the grandparents use their 529 distributions to help the kid in the last year or two, the kid obviously isn't going to be applying for financial aid in the following year, so the distributions from that 529 plan won't show up on the need application, and therefore it won't affect any need-based aid.
This is good. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors before making any investment decisions. We are taking your calls. For Kevin, 800-642-1234. The email for this is onyourmoney@wpr.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We're going to come back to talk about more about adulting and starting your financial life. It's The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Adulting. That is the topic we're talking about with Kevin McKinley today. Well, financial adulting. We just talked about student loans. Now we're going to get into the whole, I got to get around, Kevin. I need a car. How do I do that? How do I pay for that?
Yeah, and when most of us buy cars, we're given advice by an older relative, often a father, that says, you know, buy a used car because right. They're cheaper. You can afford it better. It's a better deal. And that actually is the case in the bigger picture, because the biggest cost of owning a car is not gas. It's not repairs. It's depreciation. It's the car dropping in value. Mm. And most cars drop about maybe 15 to 20% per year in value. Well, if you have a $10,000 car, that means it declines $1,500 to $2,000 in a year in value. But if you have a $40,000 car, it declines $6,000 to $8,000 in the first year value. So used is a better value because of the depreciation. But many people are not concerned about that. They're concerned about getting to work or getting the kids to school or whatever it is they have to do with their vehicle. And then they're concerned when something goes wrong and they don't have the cash to pay for it, the expense and the inconvenience of having to get the thing repaired. So if you have cash and you have some flexibility where you don't necessarily need this vehicle every single day, it's probably better off to buy a used car. But if you have good credit and a decent reliable income, but very little cash on hand, you might be better off buying a new car. You're going to have a higher monthly payment, but you're going to have a more predictable expense because you're not going to have all the repairs that you will of a used vehicle.
What about leasing?
Yeah, leasing I'm definitely okay with, especially if you know the interest rate on which you're paying it. And it will lower your payment. When you lease a vehicle, you're borrowing money, but you're only borrowing that depreciating value over the time from the minute you buy the car to the minute the lease is over and you turn it back. So be very aware of what that interest rate is on that loan. And then understand that you're going to be without a vehicle in 3 years or 4 years or however long the lease is. And so you're going to have either good credit or some cash to help come up with a new car to replace the one that's going off the lease.
And you have to take care of that car that you're leasing. How can we know that we're getting the best deal on a car?
Well, you can have someone actually do the shopping for you. You can go to a service like TrueCar. If you're a member at Costco, they have a car buying service. Or many credit unions also offer to their customers, to their members of the credit union, that they will help you shop for vehicles. But you can do it yourself. And there's been no time like the present to go online and look at places like Car Gurus or Cars.com or whatever and shop around for a particular vehicle in your geographic area. And this is not something that's evil or manipulative or anything like that. It's just the truth. When you get two or three different vehicles, let's say you find one in your hometown that's $15,000, but you find a similar vehicle 25 or 30 miles away that's $14,000. Mm-hmm. You can call the one up that's closer and say, hey, I just as soon buy this from you. I just as soon not have to go back and forth to this other dealership several times, but I don't see why I should pay $1,000 more for your vehicle versus this other one. Is there a way that you can bring the price down so that it's closer to this other option? And if they can't, they can't. And dealers have the right to sell vehicles for a price that they want to. And you have the right to either accept that price, that final price, or not. But it does give you some leverage so you can decide if it's worth the drive to save, let's say, $1,000.
Buying a car is sort of the last vestige of actually, you know, going to market and haggling. It's really interesting to me. We are taking your calls today for Kevin McKinley. Janelle from Hilbert, welcome to the program.
Hi. I have a question about our PMI on our home mortgage. We weren't able to save enough before we bought our house, and we currently owe about 90% of the home value. And I know if the PMI can't come off until you only owe 80%, correct?
That's usually correct, right? And just okay. So people know, private mortgage insurance helps protect the bank because you don't have as much equity in the home as they like. We're going to talk about this later, but usually banks like you to put a down payment of 20% down of the purchase price. It's not, they don't make you do that. It's not a rule. But if you can't put 20% down and they're still willing to lend you the money, they do usually require that you get private mortgage insurance, which means if you can't make the mortgage payment, the insurance will help cover the bank's loss if they have to sell the price for less than what the value of the mortgage is.
Yeah, we just refinanced about 4 years ago, and home sales have been ridiculous in our area. Mm. So I'm wondering if it's possible to get an appraisal done to see if our home value has increased.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. And go ahead, Janelle. I'm sorry.
I'm just curious. Is it possible to work with the mortgage company then to try and get our PMI gone?
Absolutely. What you do is you hire an appraiser. I would contact the mortgage company at first and tell them what you want to do. And it's a very good time for people to do this if they are paying private mortgage insurance, or if you do think you might need to borrow against the home equity for an emergency or some big upcoming expense. As you mentioned, in most areas, home prices have increased, and in some areas, they've increased wildly over the last 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm. So it's a very good time to look at refinancing or getting a home equity line of credit or getting rid of the PMI. You may have to pay some fees to do this. You may have to pay the appraiser fee. And understand, some lenders are hesitant to do this because they're the advantage of having the PMI is all theirs because you're paying it, but it helps protect them. So they're not going to jump right up to try to get rid of the PMI payment for you. So you might have to work a little harder to force them to do it. But it's a definitely a good investment, and now is a really good time to do it because your financial situation is better. The equity value may have increased enough to do it. And then once you're done with it, you're done with it as long as you can just make the new minimum monthly payment.
Okay, thank you very much, Janelle. I want to jump back to buying a car for a minute because it occurred to me that I could save up money and pay cash for my car. I could get a loan for my car. Which is better to do?
Well, it goes back to that interest rate. If you can trust yourself to not blow through the money that would otherwise go towards paying for the car, and the interest rate is less than 8%, which most used and new car loans are for people with decent credit. And if you're getting a higher interest rate than that quoted to you, you might want to wait a while until your credit gets better, or you may want to shop around and look at a different bank or credit union. Usually, used loans at the dealership are the worst deal. You're better off going off to a traditional institution to find that. But it's better to borrow for a car and to borrow as much as possible and for as long as possible, as long as you trust yourself to not burn through the money, because that lower monthly payment gives you more flexibility. And the interest rates right now for people with decent credit are down in the maybe 3-4% range. And at that rate, it's better off to pay a little bit of interest and have lots of flexibility rather than drain whatever savings you have so that you don't have a car payment. And if for some reason in the future you become so fantastically flush with cash, you can always pay that car loan early if you want.
We are focusing this morning on financial issues faced by young adults with Kevin McKinley. We're taking your calls this morning, 800-642-1234. You can email us at onyourmoney@wpr.org, and you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We've got Aaron from Economowoc. Aaron, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you. My question was going back to student loans. I'm working towards this federal student loan forgiveness program. I've got probably $80,000 in student loans right now, and my understanding is after 10 years, if you work for a nonprofit and you've made your payments on time, any remaining balance will be forgiven. So I've filed the paperwork. I've kept up with it. I've made my minimum payments. And like I said, I'm about 2 years in. I'm wondering if you think I should be making more than the minimum payments. And I'm just a little concerned what the risk is just making minimum payments and kind of banking on this program still being around. My fear is I might get a few more years into it and not be, and then the program might go away and I haven't made any progress on my student loans. It just feels like a little bit of a gamble. So I was wondering if you could speak a little bit on that.
Yeah, sure, Aaron, and good for you for diving into this, because it still exists. The Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program can help forgive federal student loans if you serve in a qualifying area or have a qualifying occupation. Military service sometimes will qualify for it as well. And what it allows you to do is you make your minimum payments on your loans for a certain period of time, and after participating in this, whatever's left over at this time period, then that amount is forgiven. And it's a great deal, and it is obviously very politically motivated, but that also means that it can be politically charged for people who say, we don't like this deal, we want to try to get rid of it. And there's always been rumblings of doing away with the program, and probably never more so than right now. I'm not sure that it will happen. I think, Aaron, do you know what the interest rate is that you're paying on these loans?
I want to say it's about 6-7%.
That sounds about right. And if that's the case, no, I wouldn't pay them off any earlier than I would have to, even if you said, I'm worried that this program's going to go away. What I would do is stay with the program and assume it's going to be there for what you're doing today, but be pleasantly surprised if indeed when you get to the end of the program, they really do have the loan forgiveness and you won't be disappointed. But I'm sure there's better things that you can do with the money in terms of saving for retirement, paying off other debt, paying for other expenses. And I'd rather have you do that than make anything more than necessary. The only real risk to doing this is that actual interest cost. And for many people, the money that they might put aside into their, for instance, their 401k or their 403b, instead of paying off the loan, will provide them with a better net return in terms of the tax break than what the interest is costing them over the long term.
We are talking about adulting with Kevin McKinley. We're talking about the things that you need to think about when you are starting your financial life as a young adult. So we've been we have had a couple of callers talking about buying a home, Kevin. What should we consider when we buy a home?
Yeah, it's the American dream, and about probably 2/3 of homes are where people own the home, maybe not outright. They still have a mortgage for it, but that level is kind of leveled off in the last few years. It's come up somewhat in part because, again, young adults are struggling to come up with the money for the down payment or to have the need for a new home when they're not sure if they're going to stay in a particular area for it. The nice thing about it is if you get a fixed rate mortgage, you get a fixed payment and a fixed cost. So unlike renting, your rent can't be raised. You have some control over the property. You don't have to necessarily leave just because they're raising rents or you get a bad neighbor who shares your wall. But there are a lot of disadvantages. And homeownership, as those of us who've gone through it, know that it's not just about the mortgage. It's property taxes, it's insurance, and what's worst of all is the repairs and the upkeep mm-hmm. on the place. And so that oftentimes can cost as much or more in a particular year than just the mortgage payment, and then you have to add the hassle on it as well. So as a good rule of thumb, despite what your parents or grandparents might tell you, don't buy a home just to make money because the prices always go up, because usually unless you're in the place for 10 or 15 years, the expenses kind of eat up any potential price appreciation. And as people will tell you who endured the housing crisis of 10 years ago, they don't always go up in value. Mm-hmm. And finally, don't buy them because you say, well, we have to hurry up and get in on one, even though it's not the right house or it's wildly overpriced, because if we don't get in today, the prices are going to be even higher next year. That may be the case, but it usually isn't a long-term situation, and you'll find yourself better off just waiting until you can afford the right place at the right time for you.
So how much home should we be able to afford for a starter home?
Yeah, it depends on the situation. It depends on how reliable your income is. According to the lender, your mortgage and insurance and property taxes should take up no more than 28% of your gross monthly income. Mm. So if you're making $5,000 a month, $60,000 a year, the mortgage, property taxes, and insurance should not constitute more than $1,400 of that $5,000. And all of your debt payments, including the mortgage expenses, should not exceed 36% of your gross monthly income. But as a better rule of thumb, try to keep a mortgage that is no more than 3 times your gross income. So if you're making $80,000 a year, or you and your spouse or partner are applying jointly and making $80,000 between the two of you, you shouldn't get a mortgage that is more than $240,000, 3 times your gross annual income.
And down payment, we talked to somebody a minute ago who talked about having to pay mortgage insurance because their down payment wasn't substantial enough. How much should we plan to make as a down payment?
Yeah, that standard is 20%, but certain buyers can pay less, and you might qualify as a first-time home buyer, or you might have a VA loan program that you can get on. And you can pay the private mortgage insurance for a while if you really need to get into the house, and then only pay as little as possible. Keep any extra cash you have above and beyond your minimum mortgage payment for emergencies, whether it's making home repairs or you lose your job and you need to kind of get by for a while. It's better off to have that savings and not need it rather than to need it and not have it.
So let me be clear, though. If you are making $80,000 and you're buying a home for $240,000, if your household income is $80,000, you have to have roughly $48,000 put away to be able to make that 20% down payment.
Yeah, right. That's right. That's a lot of money for people to come up with, especially when they're trying to pay rent and all these other things. And that's why oftentimes young adults who can't afford to buy their first home, they've been helped out by a parent or a grandparent. They receive some extra money for it. Now, even if that's the case, that's good, but it's not great in the eyes of a lender. The lender would like that money to, you can't just show up to get a mortgage one day and all of a sudden have $50,000 in your bank account. The lender would like to see that money mature and age in your account for a while and be there, so it's not just a quick gift, and worse yet, where there might be kind of a backdoor agreement that you have to pay this money back that the relative gave to you.
So we have heard about different types of mortgages, fixed rate 30 years, 15 years, variable rate mortgages. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, my favorite kind of mortgage by far is the fixed rate mortgage, and it's for 30 years. And the reason being is it lowers the payment, allows you to get into a bigger home or a more expensive home than you otherwise could if you get the 15-year. And you still have the flexibility to pay it off early if you need to. And usually that's without any penalty whatsoever. So the advantage is in the hands of the borrower. And depending on your state, you know, it's possible to walk away from a mortgage that you can't afford with no recourse from the lender. And so this is the reason that you should put down no more than 20%. You should pay it off as slowly as possible. You should get a fixed rate mortgage for 30 years. And a lot of people say, well, yeah, but I'd like to pay this off quicker. Well, then go ahead and pay it off. If you get a 30-year mortgage instead of a 15-year mortgage, but then make the higher monthly payment that the 15-year mortgage would require, you'll usually still pay that mortgage off in 15 and a half years. But in the meantime, if something comes up where it would behoove you to lower the monthly payment back down to that minimum required by the 30-year, you can do that and you've got that flexibility for it. And for most people, like I said, you have to have a lot of money and be in really great shape in every other financial aspect in your life before paying down the mortgage makes sense.
We are talking to Kevin McKinley about the things you need to do to start out your financial life. Next, we're going to tackle probably the most expensive thing that every one of us do, raise children. We're taking your calls, 800-642-1234, or you can email onyourmoney@WPR.org. We'll be back in a moment. Morning show. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're talking about getting started on your financial life with Kevin McKinley today. And hands down, the biggest expense most people will encounter in their lives is children. And we're going to get to that. We're going to take some calls. First, 800-642-1234. onyourmoney@WPR.org is the email. Sarah emailed us and said, first of all, thank you so much, Kevin, for the valuable advice that you provided over the years. I am 31 years old, and almost all of my financial literacy has come from this show.
You poor Sarah. Thank you very much, but please explore other options. But I really appreciate the false praise, Sarah. Thank you.
She also has a question about the 20-30-50 rule of thumb, where at least 20% of your income should go to savings. Should I be calculating the 20% based on net income or gross income? And should I include my pre-tax retirement savings in the calculation of that 20%? That's an awesome question, Sarah.
Yeah, it is. It's great. And that ratio was put together by Elizabeth Warren, the Harvard banker. Bankruptcy expert. She and her daughter have written a couple books about basically, I like them because they a lot of people, especially people who listen to the show even, hear people saying, well, I have $1 million in my 401k. I don't know what to do. We just sold this property for $700,000. And they feel about themselves like, I must be doing this wrong because I don't have $1 million.
Right.
Well, most people are actually really struggling to get by. And about half of Americans cannot come up with a $500 emergency expense if they had to. So one thing I really want to reiterate to people is not everybody are millionaires out there. And you can be. You have to save and be lucky and work really hard. But it's possible to achieve your own financial security. And I like the work of Elizabeth Warren because she dives down more into these individuals and finds just how hard it is to accumulate money and save money and become financially independent. They came up with this ratio of a way of to try to people to figure out how much their money should go in different places. And it's 50, 30, 20. And it's after tax. You take your after tax amount. And then 50% goes to your needs, like housing and food, etc. 30% can go for your wants. And that could be a trip. It could be clothes. It could be going out to eat or something like that. And then 20% should go towards savings and debt repayment. So let's say your after taxes, you're bringing home $4,000 per month. 50% of that should go to the basics, like housing, food, and shelter. And then 30% of that you can go towards extra things like saving for a trip, going out to eat, the cable bill and that kind of stuff, et cetera. But the more you can scale back on the 30%, the better. And then finally, the 20% should be going, in this case, $800, should either be going to paying off debt, in my opinion, not your mortgage or your car loan, but any other debt, and also saving for retirement. So you'd want about $800 of that net $4,000 per month going towards paying debt. So again, to answer her question, it's after tax, not pre-tax.
We are talking to Kevin McKinley and taking your calls, 800-642-1234. Jim from Cedarburg. We're back to the car question, but Jim, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. I want to buy a car with my daughter to establish her credit. Mm. My question specifically is, what will the tariffs and possible trade war mean on car models of this year, 2018? Will they hold their prices more as we go into, you know, next month in September when the 19 models start to appear on the market?
Well, interesting question, Jim. Thank you for that. Kevin?
Yeah, it's a crystal ball question. It's hard to predict, but this is a very short period of time. Usually what happens is and there's a calendar to the car buying cycle where as the new models come in for the next year, it's usually in August, the appeal to most people of the previous year's models, even though they're technically new cars, they've never been owned by anyone else, the appeal drops, therefore the price drops. I'm not sure how much the trade wars and tariffs, et cetera, will affect car prices over the next 60 days. They're not good for buying cars, you know, that are brought in from overseas, but a lot of cars that we think of as overseas cars are actually manufactured, or at least a lot of their parts are manufactured domestically. And the same thing with so-called domestic cars. There's a lot of parts that come in from overseas that go into making cars that we think of as being American vehicles for it. So there's going to be a lot of back and forth in this in the news. How much actual effect we're going to see remains to be seen. And a lot of times, even though the prices go up, people hear about this and they say, well, I'm going to hold off on buying a car. They never check the prices and they find out that the dealers have actually discounted the models substantially just because people aren't buying cars as much anymore. So I think buying a 2018, especially a new one, is a much better deal if you are going to buy a new car, Jim, and especially at this time. I would not be afraid of waiting for even 3 to 6 months because of the tariffs, but you know, when it comes to things like buying a car, it's usually not a question of if you're going to need one, it's when. And the sooner you get the new car, yes, the sooner you get the depreciation for it. But I'd much rather have people buy cars when they have the time to consider it rather than saying, okay, you had a $3,000 car. It now has a $1,500 repair bill. And guess what? Even after you plummet $1,500 back into the car, it's not worth $4,500 now. It's still worth $3,000. Mm. And you have to figure out, okay, are we going to fix this and then sell it or whatever? And life usually doesn't allow people a lot of time to consider those decisions in the proper mind frame because you have to still get to school or get to work or whatever. And so when you're ready to buy a car, I'd start shopping for it and then do it under your terms rather than feeling like you have a proverbial gun to your head.
We are talking about getting started with your financial life with Kevin McKinley. We've talked about cars. We've talked about student loans. We've talked about buying a home. Now it's time to have kids. Kids are expensive, Kevin.
Yeah, I'll tell you this. I have three children. It's best decision, best thing that ever happened to me.
Absolutely.
Other than my own parents deciding to have children as well. But it is the dumbest financial move you can possibly ever make.
Yeah, it's a head heart thing.
It's definitely, and it's all heart because there's absolutely no head involved in the decision at all. And one person did give me good advice when I was a young adult. He said, are you thinking about having kids with your wife? And I said, yes, but I said, we're just waiting for the right time. And if you wait to the right time to have kids, you will never have kids.
Right.
And that's very true as well. So the cost to raise kids just from birth to 18 runs is about $250,000. That's usually because you have to buy a bigger house to get the kids into the bedroom for it, plus food. But that's just to 18. That doesn't include college, which can cost anywhere from $100,000 to $200,000. And then after a so-called adulthood, having to help the kid out. And it also doesn't include the lost income. A lot of people have job opportunities that might provide them better advancement or better income that they can't really take because they don't want to uproot the kids and move them out of school. And so they take a different job or keep the same job that they have. But, Carrie, who's the doctor who wrote the guide to having babies way back when?
Dr. Spock?
Yeah, Dr. Spock had something about in that book where he said, just trust yourself. And that is true as well. People, just trust me on this. People much dumber and much poorer than you have had children, and everything kind of worked out okay. So just trust yourself. If you want to have kids, go ahead and have kids, but just understand that it is going to be a very expensive proposition.
We are taking your calls for Kevin McKinley. As we talk about adulting and we talk about starting out your financial life, 800-642-1234. You can email onyourmoney@WPR.org, or you could tweet us at WPR Mornings. I want to hear from parents, how much, were you surprised at how much it cost to raise kids? And Kevin, what are the financial steps that we could possibly take before we embark on this endeavor?
Yeah, this is something that a lot of people don't like to address because it involves discussing your own death, and most people do not have a will, much less an updated one that properly reflects their situation. But if you are a parent, especially one of young children, you should have a will. You should name guardians for the kids, and you may even want to set up a trust because if something happens to you, there's hopefully going to be a lot of money left to this kid, and if it happens while the kid is a minor, that can leave a lot of questions over who controls the money, when the kid should get the money as well, and usually that big sum of money is not left through assets, it's through life insurance.
Okay. So how much life insurance should we be getting?
As a rule of thumb, you probably want to add the cost of raising the kid plus the cost of college. And so you're probably looking at somewhere between $1 million on the working parent's life and maybe $500,000 for the stay-at-home parent. You might want to have that on the stay-at-home parent because if something happens to the working parent and in a two-parent household, you want to make sure that the working parent has enough money so he or she can choose to stay home and be there for the kid rather than being at work and then try to also get the kid off to school and everything and at least give them some financial flexibility so they can choose to do that until the kids are old enough for themselves. But again, $1 million for a working parent and $500,000 for a stay-at-home parent, and that's a minimum.
So we've been talking about all the other costs that we have, cars and homes and what have you. Then there's a cost for having kids to begin with, and then we've got to feed them and we've got to house them, and then we've got to put away money for insurance and trusts and what have you. A lot of people can't do that.
Yeah, it really does add up. The good news is, to be properly insured, especially for parents, if you buy the right kind of life insurance, which is term life insurance, not the kind that people are really working extra hard to sell you, but term life insurance, and you should have it last at least until the youngest child is in his or her early 20s or so. For a 30-year-old male, $1 million worth of term life insurance that lasts, let's say, 25 years is usually only about $50 per month, and for a 30-year-old female, it's about $40 per month. You should get it now. Even if you are just thinking about having kids, it's a good idea to get it sooner rather than later because you never know if some health issue is going to come up that would preclude you from getting it at that time. And you want to buy this term life insurance on your own rather than say, well, I have this policy at work, because sometimes that policy is more expensive than if you were to get it on your own. And it usually doesn't provide enough money. It's often just a multiple of salary, maybe one or two times your salary. So even if you're making $75,000 a year, there might only be $150,000 of term life insurance, and that's not nearly enough. That's only 2 years' worth of your salary to cover expenses that, again, to be frank, are probably barely just getting you by.
We are talking to Kevin McKinley about the steps that you need to take to start your financial life. 1-800-642-1234 is the number. You can email us also at onyourmoney@WPR.org or tweet us. We like tweeting, WPR Mornings. Paul from Menominee Falls, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Great program. I love all the information. I have three kids, and I've done a lot of that term life insurance. looking at, you know, trying to be more debt-free. All of those things, I think, are great. I think this is great information for young parents especially. But I've kind of lived by the adage that I've heard years ago that if you wait to have enough money to raise kids, you'll never have them. And so I think that if the conversation could be tempered just a bit with the fact that, you know, we are raising children and we're not just, quote-unquote, investing in the future. I agree with everything that Kevin is saying, and very wise advice, but I think that, and people need to, I think, plan accordingly. Obviously, that's important because you don't want to, in a sense, put yourself in debt. And then I've worked in a school where there's families that have large number of kids, and I see the impact of that as they move into poverty, in a sense, because they can't meet all of the emotional and social needs of their children. But on the other hand, too, I'm the youngest of seven, and my mom, she saved $300 a year for 10 years, mended three dresses. She saved $3,000. That was down payment on our first house. So I think that my hat's off to those people that are skimping and saving and, you know, looking in a sense to posterity, looking in a sense that they're raising children. So, but great show. Thanks a lot for bringing up the topic.
Thank you very much, Paul. I believe the children of are our future. I believe that's how the song goes. And Paul's making the distinction between money investing and person investing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. And Paul, thank you for the false praise and the real criticism. I think you're exactly right. And it is something you can't look on it as from a financial standpoint. And most people, when they get to, you know, their 50s and 60s and 70s, they very rarely are going to look back and say, we had kids and we shouldn't have.
Right.
There's certainly going to be days, trust me on this, where you say we should have never had these kids, weeks, months. But generally, people who do feel the need to do it and want to have kids should. And you will definitely figure it out.
Yeah, I regretted teaching my children to talk.
You should have just kept them mute and sign language. Write it down. If you have a concern or complaint, just submit it, and we'll evaluate it and get back to you.
Yeah, at some time that totally, yes. Especially in the mornings, teaching them to talk in the mornings. So, Kevin, I would assume that people are listening to this, people who have just gotten out of college, and they're like, how can I possibly take this on? How can I possibly start saving money here to buy a home, to buy a car, to have kids, to do all of these things? It sounds overwhelming.
I a long time ago, about 15 years ago, I wrote a book that Simon & Schuster published called Make Your Kid a Millionaire. And my best friend, who is in the financial industry, said to me, said, well, I read your book. And I said, oh, good, thanks, what'd you think? And he said, every single chapter was like, ugh, there's another thing I have to do. Ugh, there's another thing. And that's kind of what this feels like to people. But if you can do it, you are smarter and wealthier and more resourceful than you think. And if you just write your expenses down and try to minimize it, again, I'm glad that listener brought up the 50-30-20 rule, because that's a great way to start to figure out how to allocate what you need to spend versus what you want to spend versus what you need to do for the long term. And so have some confidence in yourself. Again, people poorer and dumber than you have managed to do it. You can do it as well.
We are going to try and have that 20-30-50, 50-30-20 rule, whatever it is, on our website so that people can find that handy-dandy guide there. We have focused this morning on adulting, on the things we need to do to start off our financial lives. I think, Kevin, we're going to be going to middle of our lives next week,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, lots of issues that those of us who are unfortunately moving on past and of a certain age have to deal with. We're going to be talking about that next week.
We are talking to Kevin McKinley, and thank you for joining us. Callers, thank you for joining us. Kevin, it's The Morning Show.